Hello and welcome to episode 31 of the Blue Cup Tools podcast. I am Francisco Gonzalez, also known as Grundasov, and with me as always...
Hello, I am Ben Sandler, also known as Ben304, and with me as well, not as always, is Dave Gilbert. Hello, Dave.
Hi, I am Dave Gilbert, also known as Dave Gilbert.
You need to go back to the old days and call yourself Game Geezer again.
That doesn't exist.
But it did. Ever. It did. You can't.
No, it didn't.
Dave, listen. You can't run away from the past. Trust me on this. I know as much. I know this feeling well. There's plenty of stuff that I want to get rid of too, but unfortunately, you can't on the internet anymore. It's just one of those things.
Is Easy Board even still around?
Nah, but there's still an archive of it.
Aha. Uh-huh. Therefore, it no longer exists.
No, but someone has archived it.
Oh, they have?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. There's always that one person who will go out of their way to preserve the past.
Is it not on the Wayback Machine?
I think it is, yeah. But I think Silfer has also independently archived some of it as well. So,
huh.
Yeah. Anyway, hello!
Hi!
Welcome to our podcast.
Woohoo! Good to be here.
You're our second special guest.
Ah.
Well, we had Joel Stavhauser, so...
That's true. But he was more... We caught him by surprise.
Yeah, we did. We got him.
We did get him.
That was fun.
Yes. I see. I hear that you, Ben, are playing games as usual.
I am not. That's an absolute lie.
Really? What are you playing?
I'm playing Uncharted 2 at the moment.
Oh, that's a fun game.
It's interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's, well, I mean, you just come off of Tomb Raider, so, you know.
Yeah, it's nowhere near as good as Tomb Raider, I'm sorry to say.
Well,
but,
They were trying to emulate the Tomb Raider thing. Did you play the Uncharted games, Dave?
Yeah, I played the first two. I haven't played the third one yet.
Yeah. It's... Yeah, I think they definitely... They increased in scope as they went along, but they kind of lost a little bit of soul as they went along, too. Like, the third one...
Oh, man. The start of this, I found it very soulless, so I'm hoping it gets better. We'll see.
Yeah. One thing that Uncharted 2 did that I thought was weird was that it made you replay the level. Like, the very first... It starts in media res, as they say, in writing things. And like,
I didn't quite see the point of that when it looped around to that scene again. I didn't see...
Yeah.
What the point was, like, what did that add other than to make the introduction a little more exciting?
That's the whole thing. Yeah, they make you replay. I mean, granted, they change up the camera angles a little bit, but they essentially make you play through the whole sequence again, which...
Yeah.
I was surprised at how... I didn't find it exciting. Oh, I thought it was very ponderous. It was very slow climbing up that train.
Yeah, well...
But maybe that's just me. I might be just impatient.
I guess. Also, he's supposed to be injured and on death's door, so it's kind of a wonder that he's actually able to make those leaps in the first place.
He's just but that awesome, apparently.
Yeah.
We should talk about AGS games. You've been playing Heroine's Quest, Dave. How are you finding it?
I have. I actually am enjoying it a lot. It was. It really feels like playing Quest for Glory again, except with a heroine instead of a hero. It's really good. I was actually really surprised when I was at Adventure X. Radiant was talking about the game, and I raised my hand and I asked him how much the game cost, and he said it was free. And it was one of the situations where I'm like, no, really, how much does it cost? I can't believe he was giving it away, because it was just, he spent, like, I think 4 years working on it, and it's absolutely beautiful. Everything about it is, you know, perfect, really. It's a lot of fun. It's rare that I play AGS games these days, just because I don't have time, but I really liked what I saw at Adventure X, so I made sure to pick it up when it became available.
It's the ultimate labor of love, I guess.
Yeah,
yeah. Definitely. It seems like everyone was scared to do a Quest for Glory game or could never get them finished, and then all of a sudden we've got Heroine's Quest, you've got Quest for Infamy that is going to be out soonish, you've got Mage's Initiation by the Himalaya guys. Everyone seems to be working on one now.
I heard that, I read somewhere that Hero 6 had resurrected as well, and I think they gave
source
to someone else, yeah, and they're working on Hero 6 again, yeah. Which is
I thought they released the source code and...
I think they did, but yeah, I think now they've officially regrouped and actually are pulling the project forward.
Isn't that like from 1999 or something?
Pretty much, yeah.
They started that like from before I even joined AGS. So yeah. That's old.
They started that's it, awesome. Yeah, around the time Quest for Glory 5 came out, and the fans were all rabid about getting another one out. But yeah, So I don't know what the status on it is, but I've heard it's coming back. So we'll see.
It's pretty awesome to be an old school gamer in general now. You know, you've got all your RPGs on Kickstarter. You've got all these adventure games on Kickstarter. Yeah. It's going to be good. Next year or so is going to be good, I think.
Yeah.
If they all get finished.
Yeah.
Well even if half.
That's the question.
Yeah. Well, Kickstarter's an interesting beast. Dave, you and I were kind of having a little discussion about Kickstarter last night at Loki Lounge.
Yeah, I've kind of been warming up a little more to Kickstarter than I used to be because I was always asked, like, why aren't you on Kickstarter? You'd be perfect for Kickstarter. And my answer is that I don't really need Kickstarter. I do fine, and I don't want to kind of rock the boat. And it's just such a very nebulous thing. But the more I read about it, the more I look into it, it's less about the money and more about interacting with a community. It just has such great ready-made tools for interacting with the fans, and that's a huge part of Kickstarter now. It's not just raising the money, so it's something that I'm very tempted to do. I know Janet is my wife. Janet is really, really wants us to do a Kickstarter sometime this year. We have to determine what we're doing first, and I have to finish Blackwell. But it's something she's been pushing for. I've been kind of resisting, but the more I look into it, the more I'm warming up to it. But I'm still not quite there yet. But yeah. It might happen. Assuming that it's like a year ago, I didn't think Kickstarter was a viable business model at all. But it's been like 2 years since Tim Schafer, and people are still doing it, and it's still just as strong as it was. Maybe not as strong as it was. Like, it's not as easy to get a game kickstarted, but it's certainly where a lot of money is still being made and a lot of community is generated around it and so on. So it's interesting.
Yeah, like I was saying, it's weird. I mean, you brought up the point about it's not about the money, it's more about the community. I was saying that it's weird that you can follow people on Kickstarter now, so it's essentially becoming a little social network.
Kind of, which is weird. Get follow requests all the time from Kickstarter.
And strange. I do too, and it's strange considering I've never kickstarted anything. I've never even backed any games on Kickstarter. Oops. Secrets out.
Man, you're so stingy.
I know I'm stingy. I've only backed, I can count the number of crowdfunded projects I've backed on one hand, and one of them was Davey Millay's The Big Sheep, and the other one I think was The Samaritan Paradox.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wait, no, I'm wrong. I did back Nelly Kudalot too, because I get their Kickstarter updates. So maybe that's why I've been marked for following.
Man. I've backed tons of games, but mostly because I'm an old school RPG fan, and you've got like Project Eternity and the new Torment game, and you've got Wasteland 2, and you've got Shadowrun Returns, and all this stuff that just appeals to me. Like, the only thing that's missing really is an Arcanum game. So
maybe you should make one, Ben.
No.
Buy the licenses. No. And yeah. Never mind. That's a bad idea. Anyway,
well, they've got InXL. They can do it.
Yeah. So we have you as our special guest on our podcast today, Dave. But we're gonna do something a little bit different because every time you're on a pod, well, don't worry. This isn't like the old podcast days where we would ask about like stilettos and things.
Stilettos.
Well, I think you brought that as an example last time when Zudi interviewed you back in the day. But we figured we'd have a little bit of a different chat with you than what you're normally used to when you go on interviews, because everybody likes talking to you about, you know, everyone asks you the same five questions, like why Wajidai Games and what's next and how do you do it and stuff like that. So
since the answer is beats the hell out of me.
Yeah. Since we're all game developers here, we want to talk to you more about game design and game developing and you know, things that people of a niche interest who listen to our podcast are interested in.
Sure.
So Ben, I think, has a few questions that or topics that he hasn't told me about yet, and I have a couple myself. So Ben, do it.
Shall I start? Good. All right. I think the first important question to ask is, and one that doesn't get covered a lot, is when you go into like making not just commercial games, but team games. I think, was your first big team project two of a kind?
Yeah, I guess it would be.
Do you, I find when I've been in that sort of situation, you really have to change from just being someone that does the writing to being a sort of project leader and being, you know, someone that organizes a team and gets people, you know, looking at what they need to do next. Did you find that was a big change for you?
Yeah, I mean, it helped that everyone involved was so enthusiastic about it, and we were able to maintain that up to the 11th hour. With one exception, everyone like was awesome. So that helped a lot. If none of them really cared or were willing to work, things might have been a little different, but it was their enthusiasm that kind of spurred everyone on. And you probably notice this with any project. Enthusiasm breeds enthusiasm. When one person is doing a lot and submitting a lot and showing a lot of progress, everyone else gets inspired as well. And that was definitely something I noticed with that project. It was something when I definitely tried to remember when I was working on Blackwell Legacy. And it was a completely different experience because I suddenly couldn't generate that enthusiasm from the people who I hired anymore. It was very, very strange because suddenly it wasn't something that was important to anyone else but me. So I had to kind of try to muster that enthusiasm to get other people working. So I definitely learned a lot from that. I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Yeah, it does. That's. I'm glad you said that because I was saying this last podcast. I was saying, you know, if you're proactive and if you push forward and go, look, this is what we're doing, this is what we've done, this is where we want to go. I think it really helps a team to not only see what you're doing and what they need to do next, but also go, hey, you know, this is good, this is happening, we're making progress.
Yeah, and especially if your team consists of people who are exclusively good at their one particular skill. Like I was saying, you know, if you have someone that their only experience is coding or art or whatever, it's good to get everybody together and see what the other people have been doing versus, you know, if you come from a background where you're kind of more used to doing a lot of things for games, it's a lot more easy to muster up enthusiasm, I think, if you just kind of show what everyone's kind of contributing. Also, that way you eliminate the factor of, like, you know, back when you were in school and you had group projects and one person would always do everything and you'd have like three people who were lazy and wouldn't do anything.
Yeah, with game design, it's you can't really do that because
the
project will fail. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, I have to say, even just working with Ben on Blackwell, it's been very, very inspiring. Just because he sends me this awesome stuff, and I just can't wait to get it into the game. Lately, of course, I'm kind of going on over a year on this project. I've actually been designing it since early 2012, but I haven't really been working on it full time until January of this year after Primordia was finished. So I'm kind of like in that hard slog phase.
Yeah.
And I'm finding it very hard to muster up the enthusiasm myself. So when
the last phase of a game, the last little bit is always really, really hard.
Oh, man. It's
all the fun bits done.
Yeah.
Sucks.
Yeah, I've just hit that last. I'm in the last 10%, and I finally got writer's block for the second time because I had writer's block when I was designing A Golden Wake for about halfway through the game. When I went to Australia, I actually took my notepad with me, hoping that I would get inspired, you know, by being around Ben and like just working on something. And it actually, when we were in Sydney at the hostel, it just like it clicked and I wrote down a paragraph, and when I got home I was like, okay, and I just vomited everything out, for lack of a better term. But now
that's how it happens. Sometimes just something kickstarts your brain and then everything just falls through from there. There was this one section of Blackwell, I don't want to spoil anything, but I was just having so much trouble writing it, and I just was hesitant to give Ben the art to draw because I wasn't entirely. This is back before he was working full time, and I had to pay him for each individual piece of art. So I didn't want to tell him what to do until I knew what I was doing. And then finally, I just like I started talking to some people about it, and I got like some. I got some advice, and I didn't really use a lot of the story suggestions, but there was just one aspect of it where someone said, yeah, well, maybe there's something to do with the guy's father. And I'm like, oh. And then from there, it just sort of steamrolled. So yeah. Sometimes you just need that. My wife always says, like, we always sometimes sit down and we just talk shop, talk ideas, and she always complains. She's like, I don't know why you want to do this, because it's like half the time you don't like my ideas. But it's not about that. It's about, like, through just talking about it, it just kickstarts your brain in the right direction, even if, like, you don't use someone's suggestion. The fact that they suggested something gets your brain thinking in the right direction. I hope I'm making some kind of sense here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
All right, I'm glad you understand what I'm talking about.
We get you, Dave. We know where you're coming from. Okay. We've all been there.
I think sometimes you really just need a wall to bounce things off. When you say something, when you have to justify something to someone else, you instantly realize what sounds stupid.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
I can count so many times where I'm like thinking, even like in the early days when I had this great idea for a Golden Wake in my head, and then finally it was time to tell people what the game was about, I'm like, man, I gotta really punch this up, because otherwise it just sounds really boring.
Well, if it's so, something that's stuck in your head, if you got something stuck in your head for a long time, it's always not going to be as fresh and exciting as it was when you first thought of it.
Oh, yeah.
So, sure. And that's the problem with these long, this is the longest I've ever worked on one project, and I've been involved with this game for so long that it no longer seems fresh and exciting to me. So I suddenly think, well, will other people think it's fresh and exciting? Like, what are other people going to think of it? I think this thing is boring. I know all the secrets. I know everything. So it's like, it's hard for me to take a step back, which is why I like throwing it to beta testers, because they can tell me that they liked it. I'm like, all right, it's still good. It's still, you know, a good project and stuff. But it's very hard to maintain that distance when you're so enmeshed for such a long time.
Oh, yeah. And when you play it for just countless number of times testing it.
Yes.
Let me ask you something, Dave. Do you ever, this happens to me all the time, and actually I have to ask Ben too, because have you guys ever fallen asleep testing your games?
I've gotten very distracted, but I've never fallen asleep.
Oh man, I remember this, especially when I was still doing Ben Jordan, when I was working on K6. Every single time I play tested that game, I would fall asleep. I don't know if it was just really boring, or it had a magical aspect to it or something, but I would always fall asleep.
I could totally understand how that would happen, though. Yeah.
It's the hypnotic lure of the sea people calling to you,
I guess. Yeah.
That's what it is. Yeah. That's funny. I think you said
Eric's
something earlier, which
is lulls you to sleep.
Yeah. Well, he didn't do voice acting in that one.
Oh, he didn't?
No, okay. But there was a lot of ambient ocean wave noise, so maybe it was that.
There was.
That would do it.
Yeah.
Man, the ocean really puts you to sleep. Oh, you said something before, Dave, which I think is important to go over, because there's a lot of people listening to the podcast that are either starting off their commercial game, or they're looking at getting into it, or something like that. And you said, you know, you have to be careful actioning design ideas when you're paying for each and every asset, because, you know, if you start having to redo stuff all the time, you're going to quickly run out of budget. Is that something you really had to pull yourself up on when you started doing this commercially?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I knew that every dollar spent, there's this sense that you want to get as much bang for your buck as possible. So I always wanted to design everything before getting the art made. I know Black Bull Convergence was interesting, because we were in the middle of that project. I started working on Emerald City Confidential, and I had all this money coming in from that, and I had the design, and I hired this art studio to do all the backgrounds. So I just paid them to do all of that, and they just did all the backgrounds. And I figured, okay, when I'm done with Emerald City, I have all these backgrounds ready to go. And then there were some areas that just didn't work quite as well as I thought they would. And like, there was this one scene that was supposed to take place in Times Square, and they actually drew this very nice background of Times Square with, you know, lights and neon and stuff. And I realized the scene I had in mind just was dumb and it didn't work. And all that was wasted, and I felt horrible. Like, oh man, like, I spent all this money on this background, and they spent all this time on it, and now it's just not, you know, it's just not in the game anymore. And I tried to find a way to squeeze it in, but it just didn't work.
Yeah, and so all that was wasted.
Yeah, all that was wasted. It's different with you, because I'm paying you a salary, so I could totally waste your time if I wanted to.
Yes. Let's do it.
You should on purpose. You should just, every day, you should throw him off and be like, I need you to draw a cellar full of baby dolls and nuclear waste and cats.
Yes, and they all
dance. I draw
that
in my spare time anytime.
Well,
I draw that in my spare time all the time.
I know that, but, you know.
No different.
Actually, that brings up a point. I was curious. You mentioned, I've heard your talk about Legacy, the building a better Blackwell talk at AdventureX, and you were talking about when you first started making Legacy, you had to scale back a little bit because you realized that you had these big ideas and the scale of the game was really big compared to what you found yourself actually being able to do. Have you had to do that with all the Blackwell games, or have you kind of more or less scaled back and figured out what works for you? And if you have, like, how do you feel the best way about going about that is? Because I ask this because I know that a lot of people, especially when they start off using AGS, they want to make the next Monkey Island, or they want to make the next, you know, King's Quest or whatever have you.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, their ambition kills their projects. So how do you find yourself overcoming that?
Well, I guess what it boils down to is that I was in this to earn my living. This wasn't a side job. This wasn't, a detour. This wasn't something I was doing in my spare time. I was in this to earn my living, and in order to do that, I had to get games out. And in order to get the games out, I mean, this is obviously before Kickstarter and everything, I had to make certain compromises to get the game out. And yeah, with Legacy, originally it was this much bigger story with all these different areas, and I kind of envisioned it looking like Broken Sword, kind of looking and feeling like Broken Sword. But that was impossible on the budget I had, which was virtually nothing. And I definitely had to compromise on the next game, because originally the next game was going to be Blackwell Convergence with some flashbacks to Lauren, and that ended up being too big. So I cut out all the Lauren bits and made that into a separate game. And it's funny because Unbound is probably the smallest and cheapest game I ever made, and yet it's like the fan favorite. Everyone loves that one.
It's definitely my favorite.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I pulled it out of my butt. I wrote it so quickly, and but it's
you heard
it's
it
the
here first,
loves.
Boys and girls. Dave Gilbert shits gold.
I never thought of it that way. Okay.
There's one for the box.
You're the goose that lays the golden egg.
Oh dear. Yeah. But yeah, that's basically that sort of taught me the lesson of you just never know. You just never, like, it could spend a year trying to design something, making everything really polished and really good, versus just like rushing to get something out in a couple of months and using, you know, college kids to do the art and paying almost nothing for the whole thing. And everyone just adores it. And that sort of blew my mind when that happened. That was just sort of a happy accident.
I'd go out on a limb and say I think the reason for it is just because, not to say that the other games don't, but I think Unbound just feels like it has a lot of heart. I mean, there's just something about it. I don't know if it's the 70s setting, if it's like the just Lauren's attitude compared to Rosa or what, but I don't know, just something about it. I mean, I'm personally biased because to me it evokes a sense of nostalgia. It came out in 2007. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing it for the first time at Britain's, that you and I were both at Britain's.
Oh yeah.
And it's just something about, like, I don't know, recalling that summer and, like, I don't know. Aww. For me it just brings up nostalgia. So,
well, that was a great year for you, too. That summer where I had the first date with my wife. So, I do have to say, though, like, working on Unbound was probably the most, like, it's an interesting time because I just focused on the game and really nothing else. I never thought about business stuff or anything. I just made the game and I didn't really think about anything else. And so that was nice. Like, I do kind of miss how simple things were back then. And so I think about working on Unbound and I get kind of nostalgic as well. So
yeah.
Maybe that's definitely there. I mean, Lauren is also a good character. I kind of had that character in, like, her personality, everything about her kind of in my head, because I knew that there were going to be flashback sections in the bigger game. So I already knew who Lauren was. And so when it came down to write her, it helped that she was already like a fully fleshed character who had been with Joey for a very long time. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to worry about introducing her or the world or who Joey was. It was just sort of, I could just run with it. It was just, I could just start off with them like enmeshed and everything. And that, I think that helped make it a little bit more fun. And that kind of taught me a few things about design as well.
Yeah, and for the player, I mean, you're already familiar with Joey and the whole concept of what they do, so you just kind of jump right into it. And
stuff. Yeah, that was the idea.
But yeah, it's funny because the Ben Jordan games, the fan favorite seems to be the third one. And I think that's the one that I had the most fun designing because it was also like during a summer and I was by myself and that was the summer of going crazy and talking to roaches in the shower. But all that aside, it was. I get nostalgic when I think about designing that one too. And I don't know, maybe there's something to that. If you have a good time designing a game, people will like it. I don't know.
It's funny because I don't get nostalgic for working on Blackwell Legacy. Because I nearly destroyed myself making that game. I barely slept last week. I was stressed out of my head. And I think with Unbound, I worked hard on it, but I didn't go without sleep. I was smart about it, but at the same time, I was just focused on the game and nothing else. Of course, now I have, I worry about PR. I worry about, talking to people. There's a lot more customer support emails that I have to deal with, or I have Miranda dealing with that now. But I still get a lot of emails. There's a lot of, just questions on Twitter and on the forum and everything. And there's a lot more I have to deal with also in addition to the game itself. So, and also, this has been my livelihood for so long that I really rely on these games coming out. I need to finish them. And back then, I don't think I ever really thought of it getting this far. So I could just sort of do whatever and not really think of it. And then when things started taking off, I suddenly had a lot more to lose. So I had to start taking it a lot more seriously.
What about you, Ben? Which one of your games do you feel, thinking back on the design process, the most nostalgic about?
No, they all happen so fast. This has really been the longest project I've worked on, Blackwell Epiphany, and it's been broken up with other games, and until now having a day job.
You haven't been working on it full time though for that long.
No, it's kind of hard for me to name one particular project that really stands out, but it made me laugh because you said before about how Blackwell Legacy, you didn't get much sleep, and I think when everybody starts working on big projects, we all do it. You skip meals, you skip sleep, you do everything like that. And you look at guys like Jeff Vogel who have been doing it forever, and they say things like, which I really agree with, don't go without sleep, don't go without meals. Give yourself a solid normal routine, and I've missed a lot of sleep for adventure games.
That's
making,
an understatement.
But I think you really have to, if you want to do it long term, you've got to make it a sustainable workflow.
Exactly. And Jeff Vogel's been doing this even before, like he was doing this back in the shareware days. He really has it down, and I wish I had that kind of discipline and to schedule myself like he can. I really he's one of the few indies that I just follow religiously. I just hang on every word he says, just because
he says a lot of words.
Well, he does. I actually bought his book, The Pooh Bomb, which is about just about the first year of him raising his daughter, which was appropriate to me, and it's just very, very funny. It's a great book. But in terms of like his game design stuff, when he blogs about game design, I mean, I will take him more seriously than most indies that are working today, just because he's been doing it for a long time. I'm not interested in just like being a flash in the pan and being out of business in a year. Like I've been doing this for almost 10 years. I want to do it for another 10 years. So that's kind of, that's why I admire him, because he's been doing it since like 1994, which is unbelievable.
Wow.
That's such a long time. I've been doing it. Yeah. When you put it like that, but yeah, I think like you said, he's not just a flash in the pan. You get a lot of indie people that come out and they have their big hit, and then they kind of fade away into obscurity. And I'm not saying that Jeff Vogel's not obscure, but he's set himself up a sustainable business model. And it's great. Yeah, it's really interesting to see how his philosophy differs to a lot of other people in like the indie scene at the moment.
Mm-hmm. But it's sort of Jeff Fogel's advice is making me kind of resist kind of going farther with our games, like going higher resolution or whatever. It just seems that like right now we have a nice little sustainable way of doing things. But now that I've got you full time, I know that Janet has been talking to you about doing higher res stuff. And she sent me she sent me your tests and they look great.
She I sort of Ben, when she said that, I thought, I wonder if Dave knows about this, but I thought, oh, well.
Ben was being all coy. Ben was being all coy.
To my wife and I talk.
Yeah.
Good.
He was being all coy. He's like, oh, I'm doing secret things that Dave doesn't know about. I'm like, I'm just in conversation. I'm like, Dave was talking about high-res stuff last night. What's that all about? He's like, oh, I guess Dave does know. And I said, ha,
ha, ha. She does not.
I like having secrets.
I mean, if she did want to hide stuff from me, she wouldn't hide it by telling you.
Sure. That's right, we do talk every day.
Yeah.
Good. Now, I wanted to talk to you about something that I think is very close to your heart, and that is the subject of writing, because I think there's something that all three of us have done at some point. I know you've done it, I've definitely done it, and Grundy's done it, and that is the overwordy, super long exposition.
Yeah.
And you're a very vocal opponent of that these days, and I wanted to talk to you about why that is and how you think it can be done better.
Well, it's the reason why I'm such a vocal opponent of it is because I've done that crap. I've done the very wordy, very, you know, like purpley, verbose dialogues in games, and I replay them and I can't stand them. And it's like one of the common complaints about Black Bull Legacy is just that the characters talk so much and they just don't, it just doesn't go anywhere. It's just not necessary. And I look at Legacy now and I take some of the dialogues occasionally and I just edit them down just to see how far I can bring it down. And I can bring it down by like a third and it's snappier. It's just, it flows better. And I just think that's more, it's just the way to do things. I mean, especially with these kind of games, these low-res indie pixel games, adventure games, no matter how good your dialogue is, it's still just one little sprite. Maybe their mouth moves, maybe there's a portrait, but that's all you see. And there's only so long you want to be looking at that. And no matter how interesting the words are, you're not reading a book. You are playing a game. So you want to keep it snappy. You want to keep it moving. And I just think that there's this tendency in a lot of dialogues that I see in adventure games where they just want to, they have this great big world and they want to tell you everything about it. So they just do that by throwing dialogue at you. And that's just, that's not the way to do it. Yeah, you have the thing about adventure games, the reason why it's a game is because it's interactive. So you have this interesting world, let the player explore the world and find out all this stuff for themselves. You don't have to have characters spout the information at you, like try to make it more interactive. Otherwise, why make an adventure game? Why, you know, that's the whole point of making an adventure game is that is the element of discovery and exploration. And, you know, story is definitely a part of it, but it is still a game at the end of the day, and you have to remember that. And it's I fight that battle with myself all the time. Like, okay, I have this really great story idea and like plot beats that I want to hit, but I need to make it a game as well. And I sometimes like sacrifice story for gameplay or vice versa. And it's something I'm always arguing with myself over. Like, is I got this like really important story stuff that I need to give to the player, but at the same time the player's going to be going a long time without doing anything. Do I want to have all this in? And or I might have this really cool story beat that I might just cut because it's boring to play through. So it's something it's a battle I always have whenever I'm writing.
Yeah, we've had this discussion about dialogue on a couple of other podcasts, and there's that fine balance that you have to strike between having characters who are solely perfunctory and have a little bit extra to say versus, you know, having too much to say. Because especially when you have not necessarily just dialogue choices where the character says what's on screen, when it's just subjects to ask about, you know, you can only have so much, you know, I need this information from you, or like tell me about your day or something like that. You know, it just it is pretty tricky to find that balance. But you got to work through it, I guess.
Yeah, I don't always hit it. I was telling you last night, Francisco, about when we were walking home from a bar in a snowstorm.
Yeah, that and, was fun.
Somehow the subject came up. How there's this scene in Blackwell Epiphany that I'm writing, and it's the last one. So there's certain things that I have to reveal at this point. But the reason why I've kind of been... I've kind of been avoiding writing these scenes. There's some flashback scenes that Ben has been dutifully waiting for me to write and give him the assets for. And I've been putting it off because I've been trying to figure out the best way to integrate it. Because these are story bits that if I don't tell this story, if I don't like explain these things, you know, the fans will kill me because this is stuff that I've been wanting to know for, you know, however long I've been doing these games. But that story doesn't exactly mesh with the story of Blackwell Epiphany. They're two completely different events. So it's like, how do I mesh them together? And I've been racking my brain about how to do that. And in the end, I'm like, you know what? I have to have it in there. So I just sort of am throwing it in there. I just wrote it. It's going in. So my logic behind it was, all right, it's interactive, but it's fairly simple. You get the information. It's this fun little sequence, and then you move on. So it's you get the information that you need. So it might be a little kludgy and a little awkward, and I'm not terribly happy with it. But maybe when the fans play it, they'll like it. I know I tend to be my own worst critic.
Oh, we all
and
are.
I can spend months second-guessing one puzzle and not get anything done. And in the end, I just do it, and it's totally fine. Yeah. So I might be second-guessing myself about it. So in the end, I just wrote it. And I will get that asset to list to you, Ben. I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
Actually, that's a good segue into something I wanted to talk about, which is coming to the end of the development cycle, not just for a game, but for a mm-hmm. series. Because you've been working on the Blackwell series. Well, I know you don't like talking about it, but you made Bestowers of Eternity.
We're all ancestors here. We all know.
We all know. You made Bestowers of Eternity way back in 2003?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you've really had the Blackwell story kind of in your head for about 10 years now.
And yeah, even more so if you really go back. I remember wanting to write a game, kind of supernatural mystery game back in like 1999. I first played Gabriel Knight. I wanted to make something like it. And actually, that's sort of where the name comes from. I don't know if I've ever revealed this, but Rosa Blackwell came from, originally she was Rose White, but I thought that white sounded too similar to Gabriel Knight, so I changed it to Black, and then later Blackwell. So that's how that came about. So I had that. I had this. I had no idea who the character was. What's funny is that I just imagined some girl in a trench coat, and it took like took 13 years
and, for her to finally wear the trench coat.
Five games, but she finally has a trench coat. But I had no idea what the game was about, and it took a few years for me to finally actually write a game, and that was Bestowers of Eternity. So this whole thing has been kind of hanging out in my head for like 14 years or something like that, which is nuts.
Wow. Yeah.
So I'm coming to the end, which is kind of a relief, but at the same time, I mean, yeah, I've had these characters with me for so long. Yeah, I'm going to miss them.
Sure, yeah. I mean, well, the same thing happened with me and Ben Jordan. I mean, I played Gabriel Knight, and I wanted to make a paranormal investigative supernatural game too. And yeah, so then that my idea spawned, and I made the first three Ben Jordan games in 2004. So it's going to be coming up on 10 years. Yeah, you very graciously reviewed the very first awful one for Adventure Gamers.
Well, the joke I always make is I always apologize to you because I've never played Ben Jordan. I only played the first one.
Oh, man.
Then you went and remade the first one, so that no longer counts.
Well, you're not missing out on too much. But I found that like when I got to the end... Because what I've said several times too, like when we've talked about production pipeline and just like what to make next and stuff, I always had the advantage that when I was, you know, however long the development cycle of a Ben Jordan game took, I always had the next one to look forward to, and I already had the story in my head, and I was kind of doing pre-production, which I'm assuming you probably did with the Blackwell games too.
A little bit, not as much as you did. I remember you were working on like 7 and 8 at the same time.
Well, not quite that there wasn't that much overlap, but yeah, I mean, there was times where I would get bored and I would move on to the ideas for the next one and stuff like that. But that's,
yeah, I would never. I was never that. What's the word? I was never that organized.
Well, I don't. You really couldn't. I mean, from a business standpoint, I don't think you really could afford to kind of slack on production of one game to start the next one, because yeah, then you'd never be able to get them done. But when
well, it's
I got...
funny. I mean, Ben probably remembers this. I originally didn't want to do another Black Hole game for a while, and it turned out not to be for a while. But after Black Hole Deception, I'm like, all right, I'm just going to do something completely different. And I was working briefly with Ben on this sci-fi game, and that didn't go anywhere, sadly. But then Black Hole got on Steam, and suddenly it got this whole, you know, shot of popularity. And I'm like, well, I guess I should do another Black Hole now. And then I ended up getting so wrapped up in the games we published last year that I just couldn't get it written. I couldn't get it designed. So I had to wait until all that was finished before I could start working on it. But yeah, like I originally was going to do something else, and then I decided to work on Black Hole instead. Mm.
But yeah, I think one nice thing about having sort of episodes in a single IP is that you're sort of not guaranteed fans, but you're sort of your sales are a little bit more reliable, I think. Whereas if you're coming out with something new, it's a bit of an unknown there.
A bit, yeah. I mean, the thing about Blackwell, what I always say, it's not they're never blockbusters, but they're never bombs. So I don't have to worry about going out of business and not being able to pay my mortgage by releasing a Black Hole game. It might not sell as much as something new, but at the same time, something new could also bomb. So it's there's not much risk involved, but there's not much growth, I guess, either. Although I think things are going to be different for this one, because we're kind of going all out with Black Hole Epiphany.
It's a big game.
It's twice as big as Deception, and that one was like twice as big as any of the others. And like, just visually, I think just scope wise, everything about it is just so much bigger than the other games. I mean, Ben can attest to this because you've done almost every pixel in the game except for the talking portraits, and I'm very proud of it so far. It's just all the mistakes that I might have made on the previous games, I think I've fixed now by this one. So it seemed like it's a good time to end it. Now that I've got it down, it's time to finish it. So
yeah, now that I've finally figured out how to draw New York, let's close this.
There will be other cities. There will be other New Yorks.
I know you, Dave Gilbert. So it's been interesting for me learning, like, because I've had to totally change how I draw backgrounds in order to work on Black Hole Epiphany. So yeah, it's been interesting for me, and I can imagine, like, sort of once you sort of hit your sort of writing style, you go, oh, this is good, I've got this for another five games. But yeah, you probably have to change it if you're going into another. I suppose you can mostly keep some of the same techniques moving into another genre, but you've mentioned to me moving to another genre. Are you looking to experiment a bit more with your writing? Because Blackwell always seems a bit like a detective story to me.
Yeah, I mean, I it's just a type of genre that works well with adventure games, the whole investigative conversation thing that really works well for detective stories, which is why there's so many. But I know, you mean genre in terms of other types of games or other types of story genres?
Well, I guess I was more thinking about writing. I mean, you have talked about doing other genres. Are you still thinking about that, or is it adventure games for now?
Yeah, well, I'm definitely going to be sticking with this kind of... They'll all be adventure games at their core, but my grand plan, if I was really going to go all out, let's say I did do a Kickstarter and could shoot for the moon, my goal would be to do kind of a... basically, kind of a BioWare-style RPG, just without the combat, just more branching stuff, more like you can start, like... yeah, just basically a lot more branching. I'd want to really try to... That requires so much pre-production and a lot of design, which that tends to be... That's always my bottleneck. The design is always the bottleneck. And I found that my theory, and I'm not sure if I'm correct about this or not, but I was so bottlenecked with Blackwell, because half the time when I was trying to design Blackwell, I couldn't just design, you know, what happens next. I had to think back to what happened earlier and make it all kind of fit together. I'm like, oh, there's this thing that I really need to explain now, or this contradicts something two or three games ago, and I always had to work on that. And there's always the audience expectations of what Blackwell is and what a Blackwell game needs to be. And there was always, you know, before I decided to end this one, there was always, okay, there's also, you have to think about what's going to be in the next game. What are you working towards? What are you writing towards? Mm. And I'm thinking, if I just do a kind of standalone project, there's with no continuity, that I can just write this one standalone thing, it theoretically should be easier for me. And also, I hopefully would have more help if I had a budget. I know that Janet has offered to help program our next big project, so that would free me up considerably if I didn't have to do the programming as well.
Sure, yeah. And I think, I wonder, now that we've done something like Epiphany, which is pretty large in scope compared to something like Unbound or Legacy, I wonder if that set the sort of scene for, let's go and do a big game. Let's do something big.
Well, now, I now know what I'm capable of doing. There's a reason why Epiphany, original reason why Epiphany got so big was because I knew I wasn't going to do a sixth game. I realized that the idea I had for game number six was not really strong enough to sustain a game by itself. And if I did try to make it a game by itself, it would just be really heavily padded. So I kind of took that, I took the elements of that and kind of meshed it with the story of game number five, and it made it a lot bigger, obviously. So, but at the same time, at this point, I know what I'm capable of doing. So having done this, I know what we can do next. Like, I have a feeling that I could, having written so many of these games and having worked on so many of these games, that I could write something with more branching storylines and figure out like some documentation to really keep track of everything. Like, I think I know how to do that. I would like kind of write some modules to keep track of things, and I kind of am very I'm very aware of what I'm capable of and what I'm not capable of. So yeah, I'm looking forward to doing whatever it is we're doing next, although right now I can't really think beyond Blackwell Epiphany.
Obviously not.
Life does not exist.
I've got three questions that have come up in the course of your latest talking points. I don't even know what I'm saying. I'm gonna shoot two of them at you rapid
Story
fire. I'm gonna give two of them to you rapid fire, because I think they're just yes or no, and you can elaborate if you want. And then the third one is a little more elaborative. One, did you ever keep a design bible, so to speak, for Blackwell, like a document about, you know, basically the whole plot line, where you wanted to go and stuff?
I did, but like I said earlier, the longer something stays in your head, the less interesting it becomes. And there are some obvious places, obvious things that ideas that I thought were cool 10 years ago. Like, I guess I could safely say this, it's not really a spoiler. The character of Nishanti, I had a really interesting idea for her like 10 years ago. And then a couple of games in, I realized that idea was just horrible. It was a stupid idea. But at that point, I was stuck with the character. I had already written her in Blackwell Legacy. So I didn't know what to do with her. I could do the cliche thing and kill her off or something. But that's lame. So instead, I just kind of had...
Rosa can hang up her sari in her yeah. apartment as like one of her trophies.
in the end, I just sort of realized, well, I just don't know what to do with this character. I'm just gonna quietly just not have her in the games anymore. There's mentions, there's side mentions to her. Rosa gets emails from Nishanti, but there's really, I couldn't really think of anything to use her for. There just was no point of her being in the game. So stuff like that. I had design bibles for stuff like that. But that all went out the window because things change and evolve over the course of the series. I'm very proud that the ending that I have, that I think only Ben knows because he did the art for it, that has not changed. That was the exact ending that I thought of 10 years ago.
Okay.
How you get to that ending has completely changed.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, because I remember when I came to visit you for a weekend in 2007, we went to the Mineta and we got drunk, and I got you to tell me the whole ending of the Blackwell series, so I'm curious to see how much it's
pretty
changed.
Much completely changed. Although, kind of, I mean, it's sort of the same. It's sort of the same to what I told you, but again, the way you get there is completely different from what I probably told you.
Good. Now, the second question is, I know that you've finished Epiphany, it's fully playable basically, and you've play tested it I'm sure, countless numbers of times. Have mm-hmm. you? Has it finally hit you that this is it? No more Blackwell after this? Like, when you wrote the credits roll, are you like, wow, that's
well,
it?
Well, it's very strange. Like, last week, I kind of had this bit of self-pitying tweeting session where I realized, like, I was putting off writing the last section of the game. And I was doing it. I was actually implementing the dialogue and writing extras and tweaking things and writing the very last scene. And I'm like, wow, like, I'm really emotional right now. This is actually kind of hard. Mm. And it definitely has hit me that this is it. Although now that I've, you know, I'm kind of back to the grind, I've written most of the things that needed to be written. Now it's just I'm adding all the polish and flavor text and things like that. Doing all the voiceover editing, which is taking forever. but yeah, it's definitely hit me that I'm not doing another one. It is very sad.
And now the third question, are you prepared to handle the legions of fans that are undoubtedly going to ask you when the next Blackwell game is going to be made? Because it's going to happen. I can guarantee you. And in fact, I'm going to call out right now on air on this podcast, Mr. Steve Campbell, who has been messaging me on Steam during the recording of this podcast, asking me if I would consider doing a Kickstarter for a high-res version of Ben Jordan. People are never going to let you live Blackwell down. It's just warning you since now. And I'm sure you know this.
The interesting thing is that when it has a definitive ending.
Well, like, good, yeah.
It's gonna...
Well, like, that doesn't matter. You realize that doesn't matter. They're gonna want The Adventures of Rose's Daughter, or Son, or whatever.
I think it's funny because as soon as Dave told me the ending, I was trying to figure out all the different ways that the fans are going to go, oh, this is how it can continue. And Dave kept denying it, going, oh, they can work it out.
Yeah.
That's for the fanfic writers. They're welcome to do whatever they want.
Oh, I'd say that.
No, yeah, you're opening a very, very worried
door. That has
door
yet to there. Happen. I've yet to see Slash Fiction. Then I'll know I've made it if it happens.
Have you looked?
Actually, I have not. Do I dare? No, I won't.
Don't.
If somebody you know is capable of making the Crackwell games, just think of what people you don't know are capable of. That's all I'm saying. That is all I'm saying.
We were actually discussing a Crackwell game the other day. I forget what that idea was. But I realized with the idea of Rose's Daughter continue it on, that convergence plus deception actually equals conception.
Yes.
So
there's something there.
Yes.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear. Yes.
Blackwell conception. That's worrying. Oh, well.
Yes. those are your three questions.
Yeah.
Good.
I'm just telling Steve now that he's been shamed publicly on air.
He's been shamed publicly?
Man, yes. It needs to be done because I think people cling. And I don't want to call it out, but you see a lot of the fan games and stuff like that, and you go, oh, you're really clinging to an IP that's just, you know, let it go.
Well, it's the same thing with all of these Kickstarters of the old developers that, I mean, look at the Jim Walls one that failed miserably.
Man, that was really sad to watch.
Yeah, it really was.
It was sad to read about. It was sad to read the interviews of. It was just, I was actually, I had a bit of a behind the scenes chat with somebody that was talking to one of them, and they said the whole time they were talking to him, they just had their head in their hands just going, oh, what are you doing?
Oh, dear.
I know the interview you're talking about, and you could even see it in the text. Like, I still don't see it, ... Could you explain again? that's sort of why I'm very resistant to Kickstarter for that reason. There's some campaigns recently where they didn't go too well, and the developers just completely got run through the ringer. You're so scrutinized, and it sort of scares me to go through that. But you know, I guess I'm in a different position than a new developer, if only because I don't. It would be nice to have to. It would be nice to get Kickstarter funded to have extra money, but at the same time, I don't need it. So I'm not gonna be. It's not like if it fails, it'll be the end of the world because I can still make a game, but. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens if and when I get around to doing it.
I think it's really different for especially you, because a lot of the guys that have come in and tried to do a Kickstarter have either been, as you've said, new guys that are trying to get off the ground, or people that made games 10, 20 years ago that want to get back into it. And you sort of think, well, where have you been? If you really wanted to make games, wouldn't you have still been here making games the whole time? If that's what you want to do.
To be fair, I really did enjoy Shadowrun Returns.
Me too. I love, man, that was a great game.
Yeah.
There's meant to be a new part coming out for the Berlin area.
Dragonfall. Sounds awesome.
Yeah, in the next month or so, I think.
Yeah.
I hope.
I found the engine kind of clunky, but I still liked the game.
I think the engine worked fairly well considering, you know, the budget limitations. And I say budget limitations, you know, they had a huge Kickstarter, but a huge amount of money on Kickstarter does not translate to a huge game. What,
oh, believe
you know,
$5
million is not much money when you're making a huge game.
Especially when you have a big staff, because I know that we had a pretty large budget for Emerald City Confidential, and I'm very aware just how you think you have infinite money, but you don't. It gets, because as soon as you get to that level where everything becomes so much more expensive, we had to cut back quite a lot in making that game. There was just a lot of corners we had to cut. Stuff that I actually, corners that I wouldn't have cut if I was doing one of my little low-res pixel games. So that was the interesting thing about that game, was that we had this much bigger budget than I'm used to, but we ended up having to do a lot less.
It's kind of weird that having less fidelity is really a bit more empowering in terms of what you can add. But I guess it makes sense, really.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know more than anyone, because you do the art, so you know how quick and easy it is to add and remove stuff and change stuff.
Oh, sure.
With that low resolution.
Well, Ben's a special case, though. Ben is, he's very quick at what he does. There's a lot of artists that work in low res that are not as quick.
Well, this is true. I mean, you don't do, especially for your backgrounds, because you paint them. You don't do it pixel by pixel like some artists do. I imagine it's a lot easier to paint over something than to repixel something.
Absolutely. I've actually been doing some edits of some pixely backgrounds lately, which you'd know about, I used to do pixely backgrounds, and going back and doing pixely stuff now, I'm like, oh man, I'm glad I don't do this, you know.
Yeah.
I have never looked back from getting a graphics tablet, and I know a lot of people get one and go, I can't do this at all, but not for me. I've never looked back.
How do you do your sprite animations then? Do you use the tablet?
I do them pixel by pixel. No, I use a mouse. I hate using a tablet for sprite animations.
Tablet for sprite is clunky. But what I can't wrap my head around is how you work without layers, because that makes editing 100 times easier for me.
I would say that the sort of 2,000 years of painters that came before pretty much would suggest that it's possible.
Well,
you know
what? They're all dead. That's all I gotta say.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because it's easier to like add objects and walk behinds and things like that when you have layers to work with. And I've sort of gotten used to the way Ben does things, and I kind of learned that he likes having, you know, anti-aliased edges of things like desks, and they kind of, you know, are blurry because they're painted and they look really nice. And when I first started playing with them, I'm like, oh no, like it won't be this complete perfect, you know, pixel edge, and the character will look weird when they walk behind it. They look fine.
Yeah, alpha
they
channels
look completely
are
fine. I mean, if you magical. Look really closely, you can see like a bit of the desk poking in front of the character or whatever, but behind the character.
Nobody really scrutinizes that. I mean, you're lucky if people don't say, oh my god, it's low res, what crap. So,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I thought there was one guy on the AGS forum, I forget who he was, but I posted a screenshot of Blackwell Epiphany, and because it's all blown up to 640 by 400, and one guy was like, yeah, it's weird, why is Joey between a pixel? I'm like, what?
Yeah, that was Armageddon. He actually listens to the podcast, so hi Armageddon.
Oh, hi, yes. Armageddon.
Hi, Armageddon.
Like, how did you notice that?
I'll be honest, I notice things like that as well. When you look for it, it's not that hard to notice, but
right.
I think you learn to let go of it, you learn to not care about it, I think.
Yeah.
You want to have fun, you should have Ben point out to you all of the little mistakes that are in commercial games. Have him look at some screenshots. Yeah, look at some screenshots from A Vampire Story, and have Ben point things out to you. You'll never see them over the same way again.
Yeah, I will ruin really pretty backgrounds. fans for you by pointing out flaws.
Yep.
I'm sorry.
I've never played Vampire Story.
Neither have
I. It's a pretty game, but you can notice the flaws if you really look for them. And when you look, it made me laugh. Somebody posted a picture of a map of Shanghai that had been done in 3D.
Oh, yeah.
And I went in the forum thread and pointed out where the buildings have been textured with glass from other buildings that have got buildings reflected in them that don't exist in the city. And someone said, oh, wow, what? How did you notice that? I didn't. So I went looking for it because I knew it would be there. When you've done this stuff, you know what to look for.
You know the tricks. Mistakes. You know the cheats and you know the dirty tricks.
I know.
It's the same with me with your backgrounds now. I look at your backgrounds and I'm like, I know what he did there. And I see that. And know that. So, yeah. I'm sorry, but you don't impress me anymore.
It made me laugh the other day. Well, it wasn't the other day. It was quite a while ago when you said, I think I know all of your tricks. And it made me laugh because I still got a few up my sleeve.
Yeah, you do. But I think I know most of your tricks.
You've got some things to learn, boy. Sunny.
Yeah, sure.
Actually, speaking of which, Ben sent me his commentary for Black Bull Epiphany, and I've been listening to it. I've been importing it into the game today, and it's been very interesting hearing all that stuff, just because stuff that I never thought of. Like, you sent me this room, and, it was, kind of shaded blue, but there was, like, a lot of reasons for it being blue, which I found very interesting.
Was it a reference to Deus Ex Invisible War?
It is there not was. A reference.
Good.
Well, there was a reference to that when you did the newsroom. You said you never
didn't
know what a newsroom looked like aside from outside of that game.
Out of Human Revolution, that was... Yeah, I think I was worried that my commentary was a little bit too dry and a little bit too art nerdy, like why I made the lights this color on this side of the room because that's where the character stands.
That's totally
stuff
fine.
Like,
people like that.
Which is pretty boring, I think, to most people, but I guess that's what people look into the insight for.
Well, I remember when Ben sent me a Google picture of a CNN newsroom with all the desks with all the monitors on, and he was just like, how do they have all these monitors on when no one's at them? This is such a waste of energy.
Yeah, the environmentalist in me was very cross about that.
Yeah, clearly.
It's ridiculous. How many, I was actually looking at that for a, I wanted to just get another reference when I was going back and adding details. And I can't believe, man, it was a CNN newsroom, I think. How many screens they have on that nobody's using?
And they're supposed to be the liberals.
Yeah.
Well, I used to, I spent about 8 months working for CNN, like back in 2000. And the computers are just always on because people just come by, they use any desk. So they're just always on,
Wow. I didn't know you worked for CNN. What did you do for CNN?
Briefly, I was a production assistant. I was a broadcasting major at university, I got a job at CNN almost right out of graduation, and I didn't like it very much. I remember. Yeah, all the computers were always on.
Mm. Oh. Wow, man! With solid state hard drives now, startup is instant. They should get onto that.
I think also there was a lot of real-time data that was being displayed as well, so
probably.
It's been a long time.
Actually, this is a completely non-sequitur thing, but, well, not non-sequitur because it has to do with what we're talking about, but it has nothing to do with games. But, I read recently that the whole, the news ticker at the bottom of the screen, I didn't realize that was only implemented after September 11th.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
It really was.
Yeah.
It can't be.
That's what they say, that the constant 24-hour news ticker scrolling at the bottom of the screen was only implemented after September 11th happened.
But they had news tickers on news shows before that.
They had news tickers for, like, stocks and on CNN and stuff, but, I don't know if it was CNN or if it was just all of the 24-hour news networks. But, yeah, the news ticker I thought was around for a lot longer, but apparently it hasn't been.
Hmm. Well, I know that SimCity 3000 has a news ticker down the bottom, and that predates September 11th, 2001.
Well, so I don't know.
Sorry.
Or you could say post-dates it by 1,000 years.
That's true.
It was released in, I think, the year 2000. So
I don't know. Maybe one of our smart listeners can tell us more.
Mm. Help us out, listeners.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, I'm sure the Wikipedia article on the news ticker will tell us.
Probably, but I don't. Yeah, it's. I don't feel like looking it up right now.
No, neither do I.
Yeah,
it's too good.
Yes,
but yeah, it's funny. It's funny how you went and you studied these media studies in university, and I know you've said in interviews before, like, you know, when you were starting out making games, there were no courses on how to make games. There were no courses on
writing. I was born maybe 10 years too early. Like, you couldn't major in game design when I was at university. There weren't even courses. You could maybe learn graphic design or programming or things like that, but there was no game design. So I go to these indie events here in New York, and there are all these people, like, they're game design students at NYU, and I'm like, wow, like, you could study game design. That's awesome. And I was born in the wrong decade, but whatever.
How many of them do you think will actually go into game design? Because nobody goes on and does the thing they study. No one does that.
No.
Really?
No. Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, I failed art in high school, so I was like, oh, I guess I'm not going to be an artist.
I was listening to one of your earlier podcasts, and you were talking about how you were a bank manager at 18. How did that happen? How are you a bank manager at 18? It's just a very small bank, or are you just
Bank West.
It was the Bank of Western Australia, owned by Bank of Scotland, and I don't know, it wasn't very hard. I didn't find it challenging, and yeah. I was really bored with being a teller, so they said, oh, you can learn lending if you want. I was 17 at this point. Mm-hmm. And then one day, I think the manager couldn't come in. The manager got real sick for a week or something like that, so I filled in for the week, and they're like, oh, wow, he can manage a bank. And I was 17 at that point, and then they nagged me for about 6 months to take a manager's position in a different branch, which I was like, no, I don't want to be a bank manager, man. I'm a kid.
I mean, I'm surprised I would give that job to a 17-year-old.
Yeah, so it was
I
look at 17-year-old kids now, I'm like, man, I would never let this kid run a bank. That's ridiculous. How did the customers feel when they came in? I mean, and there's this guy there.
Like, welcome to Bank United, like, sir. Can I take your order?
Yeah. But it was really weird. The weirdest thing is when my teachers came in, because I started working off in the town that I went to school in before I got transferred away.
Your teachers coming in to ask for a loan and they get
you. Yeah, man, that was really weird. That's one of the most surreal things that's ever happened to me.
That's like that scene at the beginning of the first episode of Breaking Bad where the kid sees Walter White washing his car and he has like a nice car and it's, hey, look, it's Mr. White washing my fancy car. I don't know. Hmm. Anyway.
Is it like that?
No,
is it really?
It's that scene from Iggy Goes Down where the kid becomes a drug dealer and he ends up selling drugs to one of his teachers.
Which, oh man, Iggy Goes Down, man! Wow, talk about nostalgia. I haven't seen that movie since I saw it in the theater. Anyway,
wow.
Why
are you comparing me to drug dealing people?
Because essentially, that's what bank managers are, aren't they?
Yeah, I'll get you addicted and you'll come back for more.
Exactly.
How edited is this podcast? Does it just go up like it is?
Oh, it's wrong. No, all I have to do is paste what I'm recording on my computer to yours, and it's out. It'll be up tomorrow morning.
Unless I say the word.
Don't say that!
Say the word.
No, hush. No. The name of the game that we're working on. And now No! Stop it! Now I have to beat that too!
What?
We haven't announced it yet, so I have.
Oh, okay. You could bleep it.
Now I have to go through and I have to actually do work. Damn you!
Well, we're 1 hour and 8 minutes, so you can just check around then.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thank you for that.
Organized of you, Dave.
Said Macbeth.
I see the timer on the screen, so.
Oh yeah. Okay.
We can't redo the podcast either, because my power's been off for about half an hour now, and I'm running on battery with internet and computer, so there's that. There's some excitement to the proceedings.
Oh, a timer.
That's Australia, man. Yeah. we'll run out of subjects before we run out of things, I think. But anyway, let's talk about New Year's resolutions, because it is the new year, so Happy New Year, everybody.
Oh, yeah, Happy New Year. That's right. This is the first podcast of 2014.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
We should have probably mentioned this at the beginning, but it doesn't matter.
That was stuck with us for now. Yeah. Have you made a New Year's resolution, Dave or Grundy or anyone?
No.
Well, for me, my big thing now is that I've been so, for the last like year, I've been so entrenched in work and, of course, being a new father that I've kind of like not been social at all. I mean, Francisco practically lives next door, and we don't hang out that much. I'd like to change that. Just getting back into, you know, getting back into the scene, seeing my friends again and things like that. I've just been very bad about being social because I've had so much going on with work and personal life. So it's very easy to get very enmeshed in your work when you're self-employed and never see anybody. And I want to change that. So that's my New Year's resolution.
Okay. Good. Yeah.
Well, I'm equally at fault because I haven't invited anybody that isn't my family over to my apartment yet. So I need to get on that as well. I need to get more chairs.
What a recluse. What a recluse.
I leave my apartment from time to time.
Sometimes. But, yeah. Not a great deal. Well, yeah.
You've met me at Cocoa Bar a few times.
Yeah, I leave my apartment more than I was leaving my house before I moved to New York. So,
well, man, more
socially
than,
anyway.
Any number greater than zero is going to be the go there.
Well, I would leave my house to go to work, but I mean, you know, now
that doesn't count.
I didn't have much of a social life down recently the past couple of years.
Man, you had the Blue Cup Tools podcast. What more social life do you need?
You really want me to answer that?
Oh man, well, I've made my New Year's resolution is to watch films because not a film watching guy at all, so I've sort of said to myself I want to watch one film for every week of the year pretty much. So I've just went on eBay and ordered a whole heap of films for real cheap. Man, you can get DVDs real cheap now. I'm surprised.
Oh, yeah, you really can.
So
you don't have the equivalent of Netflix in Australia, I guess.
I don't have the equivalent internet that can handle that sort of thing. So.
Yes.
And plus, if he did the DVD thing, the DVDs would take like 5 weeks to get to him, too.
Oh, yeah.
So that's going to be interesting. My
probably
first film.
I find that with Netflix Instant, I spent more time trying to decide on what to watch than actually watching something.
Yeah, same.
I'm lucky because I haven't seen anything. So I just ask people and I get 10 classic films, like must-see films in about 3 minutes. They go, all right.
Yeah,
and they're all $3 on eBay, so you know.
I sent you a list of about 13 of them the other day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I started with Cloud Atlas, which was a very interesting film. Ended up me writing an essay to somebody very late at night on Facebook about it, what I thought of it.
No. You didn't write an essay to just anyone.
I wrote an essay. Totally boing.
Oh yeah. I didn't have time to get my joke. Yeah. Well, we had an episode a few episodes back where every time we mentioned his name, I would play a boing noise on my jaw harp, and you had to take a drink.
Any reason? Just
because he wanted
get him drunk.
Yeah, he wanted to get drunk, so we decided to say his name
enablers.
As much as
we're enablers.
We said his name 45 times.
No, I don't.
Yeah, no. But you enable drunkenness in other people.
Yeah, I get
boy does
intoxicated
he.
Off the sweet joy of social interaction,
and also nice. Also Coca Cola.
Mm-hmm. Oh man, Coca Cola does things to me.
Yes, it does. It really does. You should have seen him flirting with Nikki the bartender in Sydney to get free Coke.
Oh,
I didn't have to flirt with Nikki the bartender in Sydney to get free Coke.
Yeah, she just gave you free Coke.
She just gave me free Coke, and she had an awesome Transformers tattoo.
I didn't notice your Transformers tattoo. I was too busy being drunk. Also, I didn't have my contact lenses back then.
If there's one thing I regret, I wish I could have joined you for part of the time you guys were in Australia together. But,
you can still
being born at the time wasn't really possible.
Yeah.
Who does that, Dave? Who does that?
Yeah, seriously. Couldn't you have scheduled around it?
Jeez.
What were you thinking?
I don't know.
And then you had to move house 3 times after that, so you know. Mm. Why would you do that?
Oh, because,
four times.
Well, first it was because we had, in order to get approved for the apartment we wanted to buy, we had to sell our current apartment, our old apartment. So we had the paperwork that said, yes, we're getting the money that we'll be able to use to afford to buy this new place. So we had to have already had that in motion. So that was, we had to move out of our place beginning of July. And we were told that this apartment wouldn't be ready until mid-August. So we're like, all right, fine. We'll get this temporary rental that'll take us to mid-August. And unfortunately, everything kept getting pushed forward and pushed forward or pushed back or whatever. It kept happening later and later and later. So we couldn't find another short-term rental that would cover the remaining time. So we could only find two. So we had to move another 2 times. So we moved out of our our my old place to one place to another, and then here. So we moved four times with
you
a baby.
Just done the Kickstarter at the very beginning. You would have been fine. Tim Schafer would have done it.
Well, I mean, the money wasn't the problem. Anything. It was finding a place, like, because finding a place to rent for like 3 weeks, you know, in September is actually quite hard.
Yeah. The simple answer is that New York real estate sucks.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh yes. Oh, yeah.
I found out. I mean, I had a pretty big saga trying to find a place myself, and yeah, I found out that September is pretty much the worst month that you can move in New York. But
we also wanted a temporary rental, which is even harder to find.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. We ended up doing an Airbnb, so we paid like twice as much than we wanted to. But it ended up being like 5 blocks from where we live now, so it was easy to move.
Yeah.
So that was nice.
There's a silver lining.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that answers your question.
Yeah, I like that the podcast does what it always does, even when we have special guests, where we go from really sort of the nitty-gritty of design details to, how's your year been?
Yeah. What have you been up to? At least we don't do delivery rants anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't have to do a hillbilly accent. That's a real shame.
Yeah, it really is.
I will say this, we're not going to stop you. If you really want to break into a hillbilly accent, you can go for it.
And rant about something you don't like. That's generally what we used to do.
Yeah, do you have something to rant about, Dave, other than the long intros?
Something
do you have
to something to rant about? Don't yeah, yeah, something I want to rant about.
I know that they
something
did the
that played in games or
I saw that they did that thing at Adventure X, the Room 101 thing.
Well, my rant there was and you brought this up before, getting back to the subject of actual games. You brought this up before of how this tendency to like evangelize the past and all these old IPs and things like that. My rant at Adventure X was I didn't know that was being recorded. Was just about like just that evangelization, is that the word, the golden age of like the early 90s of Sierra and LucasArts or whatever. And it's kind of, I don't know if this will make me lose fans or what, but I never like to, even though they look old because of the pixel art, I never really think of them as being old games or old style or old school, because I like to think they're new ideas. I make no references to old games. I mean, as much as I loved Heroine's Quest, there are like dozens of Easter eggs where you just see Sonny Bonds walking around or you have like Cedric the Owl randomly on a tree or, you know, stuff like that. I'm like, all right, yeah. No. It's 20 years ago, over 20 years ago.
I know.
Yeah.
And
break free of the trappings.
Yeah.
And on a lot of mostly indie adventure game developers' websites, there's this whole thing about, yeah, we're bringing back adventure games or we're making, remember those adventure games, blah, blah, blah. And I just don't like to think of, I just think that's a really harmful way to think about game development. And my point at that Adventure X rant was like, you know, adventure games aren't dead. We've won. Now do something. Do something with that victory.
I think we're better than having to always look back to the past and go, oh, yeah. You know, this is why you should play our game, because it's like Monkey Island or like Gabriel Knight.
I mean, what's interesting is that I was a kid when I played those games, and you know, you get folks that are like 10 years younger than I am who make all these references and get nostalgic for it. I'm like, did you even play them when they came out? I mean, I don't know. It blows my mind how like people who are like 21 years old are making Cedric jokes, and I'm like, were you even born?
Do you even play, bro?
Well, I'm 26 and I've played Zork, the first one, so you know.
Oh, right on.
You know, yeah, not when it came out, obviously. But yeah, you know, I've played. I think it's not so much if you played it when they first come out, but if they were a part of your childhood, like if your parents had those games, you grew up playing them. I grew up listening to Elton John. Elton John's 1970s.
That's a very good point. My dad loved Eric Clapton, so I'm a big Eric Clapton fan as well. So that's a very good point. I didn't grow up in a household that where anyone played games, and no one in my family played video games. So I don't have that frame of reference. That's a very good point. If your parents like them, they'll introduce them to their kids, and then there they go. I never thought of that.
Okay, so
my dad
this
used
brings
to play
up-
like really, really, really nerdy like flight sim games where you have to literally play them with like a notebook sitting next to you writing. Mission objectives down, and Francisco laughs at me now because I'll play like old micro sims and like read out the coordinates and things, and he always laughs at me, but it's part of the gameplay, man.
Yeah. Well, Well, this brings up an important question, a test, if you will, Dave. You're an Eric Clapton fan. Acoustic slow version or normal fast version of Layla, which is the superior one? Go!
Honestly, I can't remember which one of them is which at the moment, so...
Well, you've got the standard one, which is the standard fast one that has the really long guitar bit at the end, and you have the really the slow that's just, like, really slow that sounds almost like...
All I'm thinking of is, like, singing Layla in, like, these long car rides to Vermont with my dad, and we're all singing it. I don't remember which one. I don't know which one we listened to.
Okay, good. Well, the correct answer was the original fast one.
Yeah. Oh, I see. There was a right answer.
No, absolutely there was a right answer.
We're very much classic rock guys, so... Yeah. Anybody... I once played Layla, like, the rock and roll version... I was at a jam session or something like that, and one of the people there that was like a bass player or something was like, "Oh man, you've sped Layla up." And I looked at him and said, "No, I'm playing it how it's meant to be." And they said, "No, it's a slow song. It's an acoustic song." I said, "Get out!"
Yeah. Yeah. The piano, so, the really long piano bit at the end of the original rock one, that's its defining characteristic, I would say. But anyway, yes.
Anyway.
Yes. We're nerds in other areas aside from adventure games.
That's a lot. That's a lot.
Yeah, we're very much... It's just surprising that we don't make more rock and roll references in our games, actually.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. I'm more of a music nerd than I am a games nerd.
Well, I remember when I played one of your games, I think it was City Airwave, something like that.
Oh, man, Airwave's all about music.
Oh, yeah, Airwave.
Yeah, I didn't understand any of it. I don't get the music jokes.
The weird thing about that is that it's very much a music nerd's game, but none of the references are to real bands.
Right.
But it's very much inspired by things real bands did. But I made it for my music nerd friends, basically. And every single one of them were like, "Oh my God, I love this game." And everyone that was not a music nerd just went, "Man, I hate this game so much." So, you know.
Well, I remember
I had a target audience.
A beautiful looking game, for sure.
Thank you. I remember when I 3 days, all of it, all the graphics and animations and everything.
Wow. Nice.
I remember when I played Larry Vales 2 and all of the background songs were MIDI versions of Who songs, and it was like Phil Reed was obvious. I almost called him Phil Fish. Phil Reed was obviously a big Who fan, and I was really pleasantly surprised by that. I was like, "Oh man, this is great! All these silly references."
So there was like a TARDIS and a Tom Baker scarf, and
no, not Doctor Who, the band, the Who.
I know.
Oh, okay.
He's jerking your chain.
Well, consider my chain aptly jerked.
That's for the podcast
after dark.
Into weird and worrying territories. But that's one thing. Well, like when I play Brutal Legend, because when I was in high school, I listened to all of that guitar. I was a guitarist, so I always listened to everything with the fastest guitar playing, which was Iron Maiden and everything like that. So I played Brutal Legend, and I loved every second of it. You know, I was fully immersed, and I can see how everyone else hates it because the game looks like an Iron Maiden album cover. It's like the most perfect.
Even though I wasn't a metalhead, I could still like I knew. It was making a reference. Like I could sort of, you understand that genre of art, I guess. Like you see, it was like a giant mound of skulls with a sword sticking out of it. Like that's obviously some kind of reference. And I was kind of, when I played the game, I would go online and try to look up all the references. And it was just interesting to see, I don't know, it's just a very interesting game, even though I didn't quite get most of the references myself. It was a very... interesting but very flawed game.
Yeah.
Well, I think it probably, like Full Throttle, didn't really need the combat bits. I don't think Brutal Legend really needed the real-time strategy bits. I think it could have been... I would have liked it if it was more like Psychonauts, personally. But yeah. No, that's
what everyone wanted. That's what everyone hoped for. Mm.
That's what everyone wanted, yeah. It was Psychonauts, except playing as Hoagie instead of Raz.
Yeah.
And we...
Well, creating some work for myself in that I'm going to have to bleep myself out, but is obviously greatly influenced by a prog rock album, so we can make lots of prog rock references in it. I mean, not that we already aren't, but yeah, there's an opportunity.
Have we made any prog rock references in the actual game?
Well, the game is only three rooms right now, so no, but yeah, we could. There's still room for it.
There's still rooms for it.
Yeah.
I was actually up at like 4 a.m. watching documentaries on that album. I've been listening to it since March and I can't get enough of it.
Yeah.
It's a great album. So, yeah.
It is. We have to thank Agustin
Cortez. Yeah. Great guy.
Yep.
Good.
He is. You met him at GDC, Dave.
Which guy?
Agustin, Argentinian, the guy that
made Scratches. Yeah, I did.
Asylum guy. I think one thing about Kickstarter.
I always call him Agustin. Is it Agustin or Agustin?
It's Agustin if you're going to pronounce it in Spanish, but you can call him Agustin, I guess. I'm sure he gets it both ways.
One thing I noticed about Kickstarter was earlier in the year, they did their Asylum Kickstarter, and that was a really, really close run thing, man. I think it was down to the very final wire, and that really brought the adventure game community together. That one project, I noticed, like, I made tons of friends just by the fact that I was promoting on Twitter, and everyone was like, "Oh, hey, this guy's promoting this game."
Looping back to what we were talking about before. I mean, sort of the interesting. That's what I'm sort of learning about Kickstarter now. Is that did you guys follow Bolt Riley?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
Man. Yeah.
I mean, it's a shame it didn't make it and didn't even come close to making it. But like the community was pushing it like crazy. Blew my mind. Like, they were evangelizing this game like crazy, and I feel so bad for Odette. He's a friend of mine, and I know he really worked hard on it, but there was just this community just banded together behind this game. They really believed in it, and that was just really quite amazing. And that's really kind of one of the cool things about Kickstarter, is that it has those tools that enable you to reach out to a community, and the community can reach out to you as well, which is again why I'm warming up to it more than I was.
And that project gave me an arch nemesis who I don't think we need to name, but you know, it's always nice to have someone to consider your absolute enemy.
I don't think he's exclusively
a joke.
Oh, that was appalling.
Please don't cast a pall on this whole thing.
I think I'm ready to throw this podcast out the window into the recycle bin. But I also don't think that he was exclusively your arch nemesis, Ben. He made a lot of enemies.
Well, I hated him before that, so...
Oh, okay.
Well, so did a lot of people.
Yeah, but it's nice to see that, you know, that I feel more justified in my righteous fury against him now. It takes a lot for me to dislike somebody, but it takes very little of him to make me to get me.
I remember we were once talking ages back about how he kind of reminded us of Howard Sherman.
Oh yeah,
and Tim Langdon.
A little bit.
And all the idiots.
And all those idiots. Wow, Ben.
I remember Howard Sherman used to be like your number one, not your number one enemy or anything like that, but the guy who's like, man, what's wrong with this loser?
I was fascinated by him. I was absolutely fascinated by the guy, because he just look at him. It blew my mind.
You just wonder how some of these people actually like. I know any community, anything where anybody has some success is going to have people that come in and try and have their part of it, even though they're not like genuine people. You look at stuff like Limbo of the Lost and everything like that, and you just go, how do you think that you're going to get away with this stuff? You know, people are pretty wise to dishonesty.
Anyway.
We'll move from talking about the enemies of our genre.
The enemies of our genre.
I call it like it is. When I'm passionate about something, it annoys me to see people trying to break up what has to be a pretty tight-knit community in order for things to work. If you start making enemies, you know, it's really not good, because profit margins in indie games are pretty small as they are. And I felt really bad buying Festa Mud Curse of the Gold, because it was published by Replay Games and I enjoyed the game and everything. But
they actually approached me first.
I know.
I told them no. And they went to Replay, and I thought it was a much better fit, because I've sort of realized that comedy games just don't do well for us. So
you haven't had much luck with comedy games.
No, I've had horrible luck with comedy games. And it could be several reasons for it. It's just, but I think there's the type of game that the audience I've generated responds better to are like the more darker, grittier things. So I just said, look, it's not that I think the game is bad. I just don't think it would work well with us as a publisher, and they went with Replay, which made a lot more sense. But now that they've kind of imploded, I feel kind of bad about that.
Well, the thing
I felt terrible buying the game just because I thought, well, most of this money is probably going to go to him rather than the people that deserve it. And I was like, damn it, I should pirate this, but I can't in good conscience do that. So I bought it.
The thing about the indie community is that karma very much exists because it's such a small... I mean, it's big, but it's also small. So any little thing is going to come back to bite you in the ass, whether or not you realize it or not. Mm. So, I mean, he clearly got his comeuppance, I guess.
I mean, there are different levels of that. I mean, he was just a complete... I mean, I don't know what the word is, but...
Dick?
A complete cock, yes. He was just utterly beyond, like... the what is acceptable. I mean, you could be like a bit of a Phil Fish, I guess. Like, you could be a bit of a prima donna, or be very self-involved or whatever, but people will tend to forgive you because I don't think people, there's nothing personal about it. With Paul Trow, he made it very personal. And I mean, I noticed this with the Sam Suede Kickstarter about a year and a half ago, and I thought that was just deplorable. I mean, it was a very minor thing when you compare it to everything else he's done, but at the same time, it was just like, I'm like, what a jerk. Like, I'm just like, what's the point of doing that? Like, why did you do that? Like, you've gotten your money. You've gotten your Kickstarter money. Like, what's the point of doing that? And then he just kept going, and I don't know. Yeah. There's only so long you can do that without people thinking you're without there being a problem.
I think it's funny that he's gone from wanting to start Sierra 2.0 and get all these old designers back together to just having no faith from the community in him at all. I think what we've learned today here is be nice to people.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah.
That's the lesson we take away from this.
It still says, like, you know, tester at Sierra Online as his job. I'm like, wow.
Yeah, really? I think he worked on... I forget what it's called. It's the one that, the cartoony one that Al Lowe did.
Freddy Farkas.
Larry, and not Freddy Farkas.
Torrance Passage.
Torrance Passage.
That's the one. He worked on that some minor capacity. That's his call to fame.
Wow.
So, hooray.
Well, if he was a, yippee. If he was a tester on that, he didn't do a very good job because that game's kind of buggy.
Poor Aloe.
There you go.
But yeah, it was good to see it all sort of come to a head and people actually start talking about it. Because for a while there, I thought that it would all kind of go unnoticed, you know, by the indie game community at large. Because you've got the indie game community, but then you've got the adventure game community, and they don't really overlap very much. So it worried me that his antics would go sort of unnoticed, but they didn't.
Yeah. Of course. So there's only so far that could go. I mean, even Howard Sherman, and he's sort of involved with a much smaller community. It's sort of the same thing, except that Paul, I don't know, he's just Paul.
Did you ever play one of Howard Sherman's games?
I tried playing one of the demos, but...
The writing looked really bad.
It was awful. I mean, it was just... First of all, it was just full of bugs, and I couldn't... And he's charging $40 for his games now, and
Jesus Christ.
I mean, his logic is that Infocom charged that like in the 80s, so he should charge that too. It's like, yeah, but they had like packaging and retail and all this other stuff. Like, I don't know, whatever. I'm sure, and presumably he's still around and doing it.
A Nintendo, like an original Nintendo, costs $380, but you wouldn't pay one that much for one now.
No,
but yeah,
I'm sure some crazy people would on eBay.
Oh, yeah. Oh, are you kidding? Yeah, of course they would.
But yeah, it's good. This is a very interesting conversation tangent we got into. I'd forgotten completely about Howard Sherman because I never hated him quite as much as I hated Tim Langdale, because Howard Sherman was just a liar, whereas Tim Langdale was out to hurt people. So I usually get more.
Well, Howard Sherman, I never hated him so much as just was fascinated by him, because he just seemed to be living this world of such delusion, and like, maybe he has sold 200,000 copies of all of his games at $40 a pop. But if so, you'd think that you would have heard of them. They would have been like some forum, or people would be discussing them somewhere.
Yeah.
But hey, I went onto his website, and there was a very, very positive quote from a D. Gilbert on there.
Oh, no, there's a Dave G, not a D.
A Dave G, that's G. What it was.
Yeah, oh. I thought too. Yeah.
Well done. Well done. You know, nice to see that, that an esteemed developer like himself sort of has the respect of his peers.
Well, that quote was actually there before I wrote anything. I discovered him when I was working on Blackwell Legacy, and I just was fascinated by it. Everything he did, I was just fascinated by it. I'd Google him like all the time just to see what he was doing. And now he's not doing that much, but
I used to have this issue. I'm a very happy, imbalanced person, so every now and then I have to just induce some rage in myself. So I used to just look up things about Tim Langdale just to just give myself 5 minutes of just hating everything in the entire world. And I go, right, that's it. I've had my hate for the week. Back to being happy again. Well, you know.
So that's your secret. That's your secret.
That's how I do it. I get it all out 5 minutes and then I'm done. I'm gonna have to find someone new now that replay games are sort of all falling in a heap. I'm gonna have to find someone.
There'll be someone.
There always is.
You have to find a new Moriarty.
It'll probably be me. I don't know. I'll say something that'll piss someone off, and then you know.
No, you can. I think unless you're absolutely trying to be a liar or trying to be a bully, no one's gonna. Sort of, you don't get a community hating you unless there's a real reason for it. You know, you might have people who hold individual grudges, but yeah, who cares about that?
I just remember at GDC, I think I had a bit of a drunken rant about things, and I don't remember what I said, but
that night was amazing.
I was worried. Day, I'm like, did I just totally ostracize myself from everybody?
No,
but
you
no
didn't
seem to remember what I said, so that was good.
Yeah, or well, nobody remembers anything at GDC. Everybody's drunk at GDC. I remember one of my favorite overheard bits was because we got pretty drunk at the Wild Rumpus party that Wednesday night, and the next day I was on the show floor and I heard someone say, "Oh, so and so isn't feeling too well. He drank too much at the Wild Rumpus party," and the response was, "Everybody drank too much at the Wild Rumpus party," which is very true.
All right, guys, listen, I think I should probably get going.
Yeah, we should wrap up our podcast. We've been talking
for a long time. Thank you very much for being a guest. It was good to talk to you.
Yeah, I mean,
some very interesting insights.
Yes. Any time. This was a lot of fun.
Yes.
Good.
Good.
All right.
We'll need to find another enemy of the genre before, you know.
I'm sure some of them. That'll be the name of the podcast. Enemy of the genre.
Yes. Good.
Good.
All right, well, that is our podcast. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Grudislav Games. Ben is at Ben_304. And Dave, who is has a lot more followers
much
than
more
either of us to combined. If you are not following him, what is wrong with you? If you listen to this podcast, you are.
Your Twitter. Oh, you're asking me. Oh,
yes.
Okay, I'm at Wadget I Games. That's Wadget with a J.
Yes.
Wadjet.
Good.
Wadjet. I am tired.
It's cool. And of course, go and play all of the Blackwell games and all of the other games. And yes.
Good.
All right.
All right. The games.
Yes. All right. On that note, thanks for listening to the podcast, and we'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye, guys.